Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 413 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 18th of January, 2019, as I record this. So today I'm talking to Paul Jarvis about how to be a successful company of one, which is the name of his latest book, which is fantastic. And I had it on pre-order, and I got an early edition as well. So really excited to bring this to you today. And we question the whole idea of growth, which is kind of hilarious in the world we live in, where it's all about growth and getting bigger and all this. And the decisions you need to make around scaling your business financially, so i.e. making more money, but not scaling the potential size, so without hiring more people or any people, in fact. And this is a particularly interesting timing. So if you're someone who listens to Pat Flynn's podcast, excellent podcast, Pat Flynn's Smart Passive Income podcast, or SPI. Pat has been podcasting about the same time as I have, but he's made exponentially more money. But interestingly, Pat has just announced that he's taking on lots of employees and becoming a bigger company. And the most recent episode with Matt Gartland, who's also been on this podcast a while ago, is around moving towards bigger growth. And it was great for me to listen to the show at this time of putting out Paul's interview, because sometimes you need to clarify what you don't want in order to know what you do want. And this has actually been something that's happened over and over for me in my life in terms of business. So, for example, I ran a scuba diving company for a very short amount of time because I realized very quickly it was not what I wanted. So the massive variable overheads of oil price and petrol cost and insurance and managing people and just so many things. And that really helped me make a decision that I don't want a physical business. And then also we did property investment. And I realized then I don't like being in the weeds of doing up houses. Like, I really don't care what type of paint is the best thing for rentals and things like that. You know, the stuff you have to care about if you want to be successful in like doing up property. And then of course I was an IT consultant, and one thing I definitely didn't want to do is spend all my time working for money. I wanted a scalable business. So everything I've learned over time, like the failures in inverted commas that I've had, have helped me understand what I want. And so, yeah, it's great to listen to Pat's show and go, brilliant, good for Pat. That's not what I want. And this is kind of what Paul says in this interview, which is, you know, you don't have to grow. You don't have to have loads of employees. You can work with freelancers. You can, you can get to a really good level of income as a one woman band. or as a partnership team, for example. So that's useful. And also, I was really thinking about, you know, the life I'm moving towards, and I'm really getting there. I'm making steps toward it every year, which is I want a quiet life. You know, I'm an introvert. I think so much of what I've done over the years with the speaking, for example, is push myself. Importantly, I needed to go through that phase, but I like being quiet. I do like meeting people. I like learning things, but I want to make good money. I like making money. Absolutely. I like scalable revenue, but I want to experience the world. I want to travel. I want to do more things, have more experiences, write my stories and write my thoughts and help people through my writing and my podcasting. And so I'm really moving towards that, where everything, all the work I do kind of feeds into the life that I want to live. And I have a wonderful team of freelancers, but no ambition to grow the company. I'm not going to publish anyone else. You know, I do have published people I co-write with, but I'm not becoming a publisher like some indies are doing. I'm not building that anymore. So yeah, I hope you find today's interview useful. if you're kind of thinking, how can I scale? It doesn't have to mean scale the business side. You can scale your revenue without scaling kind of your fixed and variable cost. So in publishing news this week, this is not so much news as something I think is really interesting around publishing that I had a revelation about. When I heard Dean Wesley Smith talk about this a couple of years ago, when I've been to Dean and Chris's business workshops a couple of times, they're fantastic. And this week, Dean posted an article on secondhand sales. And I remember when he changed my mind on this. And so I recommend you read this article, which I'm linking to in the show notes, if you don't really understand why secondhand sales are a good idea. So first of all, Dean explains the first sale doctrine, which applies for secondhand sales, which is once the book exists in paper format and you are paid, you, the author, the rights holder, the publisher, once you're paid for that first print sale, it belongs to the person who has the book and they have the right to resell the book artifact, not the contents. They don't own the content, but they own that particular physical artifact in the world. And Dean talks about how amazing the secondhand market is for marketing. And studies show that a physical book may have 6 to 10 readers over its lifetime, with the added bonus, of course, if people are reading a physical book, other people can see the cover. So you get that kind of built-in marketing as well. And this actually, in a combination with visiting a number of secondhand bookstores in America, particularly. So I went along to the last one I visited was in Florida when I went to Nink in St. Pete's. And I went to the big secondhand bookstore there. And I was like, okay, I'm really convinced as to hardbacks in secondhand stores because they last longer, they have a higher price and they're valued higher. And so this is really interesting. And so part of me getting into hardbacks is for this idea of a secondhand market. And I did talk in the trends for 2019 a few weeks ago about indies will do more print in 2019. And this is definitely part of it, as well as libraries, which I think we're all starting to talk about and I'm definitely getting more into. So actually, this is a call out. If you are selling massive numbers of books in libraries, I would like to know about it. So you can email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com, because I do think library sales are something, and I'm talking about this in a few weeks' time around audiobooks, because digital audio in libraries is massively growing. But I think marketing to libraries is something that a lot of us miss. I certainly miss. So my personal update is more reflective this week, because Mary Oliver died yesterday as I record this. And Mary Oliver, Pulitzer Prize winning poet and much loved by anyone who loves nature and words and poetry. And I bet you have heard of her being a writer. I imagine you've heard of her, or if you're into poetry, you no doubt have her on your bookshelf. And her poem, Wild Geese, and you can go look that up on the internet if you don't have it on your shelf. That poem means a lot to me and I still read it. I still read it a couple of times a year. Because it challenges me, it makes me think and helps me live in my body in the world instead of in my head all the time. So I read that poem this morning along with one of her essays about her life, and she very much talks about being in charge of her life and the freedom and not letting people control your life, which is really interesting to read that from her this morning. She leaves behind a remarkable body of work. And that also has challenged me today, because I'm super proud of the books I've put out. I'm really proud of them, particularly proud of probably The Successful Author Mindset, which is definitely my deepest book in terms of nonfiction. And also, even turning How to Write Nonfiction into what I did last year is much, much deeper now. And this kind of deepening process with my fiction also, somebody emailed me about Valley of Dry Bones and said it really was a lot. It went a lot further than some of my other books. And certainly Desecration gets a lot of that feedback as well. So I feel like for me as a writer, as a crafts person. I need to get deeper. I need to go deeper into my books. And my new website, which I am building, and if you're on my content marketing course, you know about it already, but I'll announce it on the podcast in the next month or so. But basically, that will be part of my own deepening as a writer because of the things I want to talk about and the things I want to write about. So the challenge for you, and it's not sad that Mary Oliver died. She was 83, I think. She lived really incredible work that she put into the world, you know, is amazing to be proud of. I mean, obviously, it's sad when anybody dies, but she lived a full life, a full creative, incredible life. So it's not a sad reflection. It's a positive reflection on how can we learn from Mary Oliver? How can we go deeper into our own writing? How do we create a body of work that matters? And that is something I want to really focus on as I go forward. The other thing, like on a completely different note, the other thing right now is I am loving Marie Kondo. And I know this will probably be a little bit controversial, but this idea of sparking joy. I think everyone had a pretty difficult 2018. I feel like certainly the political environment in the UK, the US, and a number of other countries around the world is difficult. And I think the reason Marie Kondo has taken off so much is because of her focus on, does this spark joy for you? And if you ignore the fact that some people are unhappy that she says get rid of books, and she doesn't say get rid of all books. She says get rid of anything that doesn't spark joy for you. And to be fair, over my lifetime, I'm 43, I've probably bought tens of thousands of books. I mean, right now in my house, there's about probably 600 physical books. And on my Kindle, I've probably got 2,500 that I have, in quotation marks, bought because I like to have them there so I can reread them, which is crazy. I have audiobooks. I have, you know, and that doesn't include the thousands I have let go. Like when we left Australia, we got rid of 2,000 books because we like shipping books all over the world. So anyway, the point is, coming back to where she talks, what she talks about is, does this spark joy for you? And that might be in physical objects. So, you know, that dress you've been holding on to for years because you might get into it again one day. Does that really spark joy for you or not? And I've been looking at some of my physical stuff. I mean, we're pretty minimalist apart from books. We've really been hoarding books, but pretty minimalist. And lots of things. Anyway, the other thing I think is really interesting is the TV show is fantastic because I was like, how are they? Because I haven't read her book. I've just seen the show. And I was like, how did they turn this book on like tidying up and folding things into a compelling TV show that everyone's talking about? So I started watching it. And then, of course, I've binge watched the whole thing because I love it. It's a bit like if you've watched Queer Eye in the same way. It's actually a personal transformation story. So, you know, Marie arrives and it's usually a couple and they've got problems in their relationship. Their house is a total mess. You know, maybe they've got kids or dogs or whatever. Anyway, by the end of the show, there's conflict. They go through conflict over what to get rid of and how they're going to change their life. By the end, they've changed their life. Their relationship's amazing. It's like a story, a character arc within the story. So Marie is almost not even a narrator character. She's almost not incidental, but the story is a character shift. So that's why the show, I think, fascinates me, because by the end, I'm like, oh, look at that lovely couple and how happy they are. And it's very interesting TV in terms of how you can adapt a non-fiction book into a reality TV show that really works. So yeah, some loads of things I've been learning. I also love the fact that she doesn't judge people on what sparks joy. So some of the things that people are like, oh, this really sparks joy for me. And her face is completely neutral. Like she doesn't go, oh, why would you want to keep that? You know, which is probably what I would do. I'd be a bit judgy about it. Like, why would you keep that? It's 25 years old and it's, you know, horrible. And that's great because, for example, I have loads of books on death culture, tattoos, graveyards, cemeteries, medical history, you know, all the kind of darker side books. I have a lot of those books. If you know Paul Koudinaris, his books, I have all of his. So these spark a different kind of joy, like a dark joy for me. And so they are keepers. They do spark joy. Whereas a novel, I don't have any print novels. That might be blasphemous to some of you, but I read digital ebooks for fiction. But, you know, really thinking about what sparks joy. So that's another question for you today. What sparks joy for you? And if there are objects or situations or things in your life that are not sparking joy, or if you look around and you go, it's fine, obviously, not everything in your life is going to make joy. But if you're looking around and nothing sparks joy, then probably time to make a change. Okay, and then on my working situation, I'm going to start talking about my projects as my asset creation time. I think it's really important that we focus on the fact that authors create intellectual property assets, and assets put money in our pocket over time. Assets create income, and that's awesome. And that's part of my becoming a better publisher this year, is putting my existing work into other formats so that I can make more streams of income from my existing body of work. So I have finished editing 1,000 Fiendish Angels, my three short stories based on Dante's Inferno that very much are from my dark side. And I have narrated these after, what is it now, a couple of months worth of coaching before Christmas. And they are with the wonderful Dan Van Workhoven, my podcast audio tech, now my audiobook tech. And he's going to do the mastering. I will do the pickups, which are the things that, you know, need redoing. And then they will be going out into the world. And after that I've written my next book, I will be doing a mini course on audio stuff. So many of you have been emailing me going, please, can you share more about how you narrate your own book? How you use a narrator? How do you do audiobooks? Should you do this? Should you do that? How do you do podcasting? How can you be a guest on a podcast? So I'm going to cover those in another mini course, which will be after the next novel. And in terms of my planning for this, I'm finishing the Productivity for Authors. So this is my next mini course. That will be out by the end of January, which is on habits and goals and finding time to write, how to use time effectively to write. And so I've been working on that, and I will be finishing the prep on that and recording that before end of January. And I'm also doing 1,000 Fiendish Angels. I've updated the ebook files, and I've also got that done for print. So that's going to be out in print in the next week, probably. So lots of ticks in terms of turning things into more streams of income, which I am excited about. Then in useful stuff, this is coming to intellectual property in general. And this really is only for those authors who have a number of books and are starting to kind of put things on spreadsheets and wonder when contracts expire, and really want to know where they've submitted things. I mean, if you've got lots of short stories, this would be useful too. Basically, at the moment, most of us just have spreadsheets. Most of us keep lists of our books, ISBNs, where they're published, which formats they're in. And my spreadsheet is out of control. And one of the things I said at the beginning of the year is I am going to sort out my IP management. And miraculously, in the last week, a Kickstarter has gone up for, and I'll read it from the Kickstarter. Intellectual Property Tracker is a web-based software that allows writers to track all the important information associated with their product, their intellectual property or IP. Taglines, blurbs, sales copy, keywords, vendor and platform links, details about formats, publication history, submission history, IP rights management, details about advances, contracts, and promotion history. Instead of keeping this important information in a tangle of spreadsheets and various documents, pieces of paper, etc., Intellectual Property Tracker allows you to have all the information in one place. Now, this is a Kickstarter. I have backed it immediately because I was like, yes, please, we need this. We really need this. So you can also back this. I will link to it in the show notes. So this will be reasonably time sensitive because, of course, Kickstarters are only available for a certain amount of time. So you can go, if you just go to Kickstarter or just Google Kickstarter Intellectual Property Tracker, it will come up. Or you can go to the show notes, as always, thecreativepen.com/podcast, and go to episode 413 and you will find the link. So that to me is super useful and I'm really looking forward to that coming out. That's actually more evidence that we're in quite a mature phase of being indie authors, because this is specifically aimed at indie and hybrid authors. Although I think if you're traditionally published, this is also useful, especially if you have a large backlist and you want to keep an eye on all your rights, which you should, because it's your intellectual property. So very, very cool. Hope you will check that out. So thanks for all your emails and tweets this week. JP Choquette says, what an interesting concept, using Google Voice or Alexa for book recommendations. I would never have thought of this. One more reason to love my visits to your blog and podcast, Joanna. Thanks, JP. Melissa Green says, geeking out over voice, I'm subscribed to Brad's podcast, which is This Week in Voice. I use a screen reader. I guess that could count as voice tech, and I have a Google Home. Off now to read Lindsay's article. She's such an inspiration. Indeed she is. Poor Nima says, enjoyed this episode with Bradley and learned a lot. I tune in to discover the trends with staying power on your show. Keep it up. Thank you, and I surely will. And a few more, but finally, I'll share Another World Audiobooks says, getting inspired for 2019 with At the Creative Pen and a good kettlebell workout, with sent a picture with a kettlebell. Excited to take things to the next level and always appreciate your advice. Thank you for that and good working out. And we are healthy writers in 2019. Woohoo! Right, so today's show is sponsored by Drafted Digital, and I will play a word from the lovely Kevin Tomlinson in a minute with the sultry voice. So this type of corporate sponsorship that I mentioned on some of the shows pays for the hosting, the transcription, and the audio editing. But my time in creating the show and preparing the material and doing the research and everything is sponsored by you guys on Patreon. And thank you to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. It continues to be really important to me to prove that you actually want me to do this show. As I, you know, head towards 10 years, it really, you know, some days I, as you know, I keep talking about this, but I'm still oscillating. I said I'd get to 500 though. So thanks to new patrons, Dan Jacobson, Chris Schuler, and also thanks to Gilbert Gaudriol for doing a whole year's support in one go. And it reminded me that, and several people have done this, they've said they don't want to use Patreon for whatever reason, and they would just like to donate. And absolutely, you can just do a one-off PayPal donation and I'll give you access to the Q&A audios, which are the extra audios. So just email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com, if that sounds more like you. And I just did the January patron-only Q&A. So if you are a patron, you will have got that email, and that's another 45 minutes of audio every month where I answer questions from patrons, all of which are usually, well, of course, they are about writing, publishing, book marketing, and making a living with your writing. I really appreciate your support. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do it for less than a coffee a month at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on with the interview.
Hi, this is Kevin Tomlinson with Drafted Digital, bringing you the DDD Smart Author Tip number 7. Did you know that DDD can get your books into Amazon? How about Walmart.com? Apple, Kobo, Barnes & Noble? Man, we reach a lot of retailers worldwide. If you've been wondering about how to get your ebook into a particular retailer's storefront, there's a really, really good chance we can help with that. In fact, that's kind of our thing. Make publishing so easy, all you have to do is write your book. We'll take care of the rest. Start reaching a bigger audience now. Convert your manuscript, distribute it online, and get support the whole way at drafteddigital.com/pen. Sign up now and get a free author marketing guide, drafteddigital.com/pen. Happy writing.
today I'm here with Paul Jarvis. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining me. Just a little introduction. Paul is a writer, a designer, a podcaster, an online course teacher, and software creator. His latest book is Company of One, Why Staying Small is the Next Big Thing for Business. And as soon as I heard about this, probably, I don't know, you started talking about it on your newsletter a while ago, and I was like, I need to have you on the show because Company of One is such a great title. But before we get into the book, tell us a bit more about you and how you got into writing.
Yeah, so it's funny. A few years ago, my mom sent me a package, and in the package was a bunch of books. I'd forgotten I'd written them, a bunch of books that I'd written in grade school. And they were pretty long as well. They were all illustrated. It was about a hamster that was also a Top Gun pilot. I don't know. It was kind of
cool.
Yeah. So I think I've always enjoyed writing. I think I forgot that I did in my early adult life. And I'd always wanted to, as an adult, I'd always wanted to write. I just kept telling myself this silly story, like, you aren't a writer. And then I realized one day, hey, wait a second. If I just started writing, then I would be a writer. And then that voice in my head saying I'm not a writer wouldn't be, that would not be true anymore. So I started writing articles. I've kind of always blogged on and off, but for probably about 6-7 years ago now, I wanted to see if writing could be a viable like job or something I do for work. So at the time I was a web designer, and I figured, okay, if I can, I'll separate out the income that I make for web design and then the income that I could make on writing. And then if the writing income ends up making more than web design, then maybe I'll switch from being a web designer to a writer. So the first book, it's funny, the first book that I wrote cost me $0 because at the time, I like to do these weird experiments and my wife just kind of plays along where I didn't want to buy anything for an entire year. And the first book that I wrote was a cookbook, and all of our plates and cutlery, I wanted to have photos in the books. Most recipe books have photos. All of our plates are kind of ugly. we don't have fancy things. So I basically figured out a way to do the book for $0. So a friend of mine was a pastry chef at a 5-star restaurant. So I borrowed lots of stuff from their kitchen. My friend, who was an editor, needed some web work. So I traded her editing for web design. The photographer, I was like, hey, you can eat all of the things you photograph. Do you want to help out? So she said, sure. So I produced the book for $0 and I spent literally nothing on the book, and I released it. And then as it started to make money, then I had money to spend a bit more on the next book. And then as that book made money, I had a bit more to spend on the next book. So I really kept things separate because I wanted to really make a go of, hey, if I want to do writing, let's see if I can do this as a viable source of income. So that's kind of how it started, with trying to spend $0 on anything.
Which is awesome. And we're going to come back to questions about scaling revenue without expenses, because I think that's really interesting. But I wanted to just come like straight back to the title, because A Company of One, many writers listening, they might be writing fiction or nonfiction, but they feel like they're a writer or an author and they're one, but they don't necessarily feel like they're a company. So what in your mind differentiates a company from someone just writing a book and trying to make a little bit of cash?
Yeah, I think so. Companies need revenue. And I think that I think there's different levels of being a company. Like, you can have a part-time company, you can have a business on the side where you're maybe writing evenings and weekends and you're making enough for extra money to put into savings or to like go on vacation or that sort of thing. But I think if you're looking to make a company, like a full-time company, then it needs to make enough revenue to support all aspects of your life, just like your day job should support like your rent and your mortgage and food and car payments or whatever it is that you spend money on. So I think that's probably the definition, is it needs to be profitable in some way. And I think there also needs to be some kind of longevity, because especially with writers, you can write a book that does well. It's hard to write a lot of books that do well, but I think that's really the goal, is to have a continued career doing this as opposed to just one book. I think it's hard to write your first book, but I think it's harder to write your second book. at least for me, it doesn't get easier. I think I'm on book five. It doesn't really get easier. And I think to define what a company of one is, I think that's really just any business that questions growth. So it can be a one-person business. It can be a 50-person business. The whole thesis of the book is that growth isn't the byproduct of success. Choice is a byproduct of success. Their freedom to choose is a byproduct of success. So in that way, you can be a one-person business and do well and decide, hey, I don't want to grow. Or you can be a one-person business and do really well and say, hey, I want to grow, say, a small team or an even bigger team. But it's just a matter of deciding what makes sense, because growth doesn't always make sense. It just sometimes makes sense. So for me, I have a small team that I work with, especially for writing, because I'm not good at all aspects of writing. So I have a bunch of people that I work with to really make my writing better, to be honest.
And I think, I always preach on this show, you know, hiring an editor, hiring book cover designer, hiring web help, you know, for people who aren't very technical, like you have to hire out those things, but you can do freelancing and work for hire. You don't have to have employees, which is kind of what you're talking about. But it's interesting because the enough number is really interesting. And I want to talk about that because authors are pretty obsessed with book sales. And before we started recording, you said how many podcasts you're doing. Like, your publisher clearly wants you to sell some books, right? You don't just put the book out there and you know, happy days, it's out. So you have a number of things. You talk about the enough number, the beast, the hungry ghost, and also ego. And I wonder if you could talk about how these things relate to the author life and book sales.
Yeah. So to the first point, enough. I think that when we start any business, whether it's writing or anything, we start kind of at zero. Like, you don't say, oh, I want to be an author, and you have 10,000 people or more lined up to buy copies of your book. That sounds great. I would love if that happened. I don't actually think that that ever happens. So I think in the beginning, we all start in this kind of pre-enough phase. So we're all working towards, we're all growing towards having enough to support ourselves in the career that we have in writing. And so we have to adopt this kind of growth mindset where we need to sell enough books or we need to generate enough revenue. But where I think things can go awry is when we don't question whether or not we've hit enough. Because in, like, say, startups, same as in writing, we just think that, oh, we need to sell more, 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 more. And at some point, it could be that we have enough book sales or we have enough of an audience that can support us. And we can make decisions to optimize for enough as opposed to optimizing always for growth. It's just like with writers, oh, well, maybe I could sell more if I watered down my writing or I made it more palatable to more people. Or when in reality, it could be more along the lines of, I just want to write books that relate to the audience that I have, however big or however small. If they're enough to, if I'm selling enough books to make a decent living, then maybe that's all I want. Maybe I don't want to be noticed at the yoga studio or out for groceries. that to me wouldn't be a life that I want. I would rather be known to a small group of people who support my enough, as opposed to like recognized when I'm out or having to do like talk shows and travel all the time. Like, that to me isn't success. I like the life that I have. So I think that's kind of enough. The hungry ghost kind of applies to that. It's a bit of a Buddhist story about how there's this hungry ghost that's never full. And I think that really relates to enough, because a lot of times we just want more and more and more, and we don't think about why. And that's kind of the hungry ghost story, where our appetite is never completely full. And a lot of that relates to ego. And I think ego is a good thing, because we need to think, we need to have enough ego to say, I want to write something that matters. I want to write something and share it with other people. That's the good side of ego. That's all writers should have, that where they want to share something, because I think everybody has a great story in them to share, whether it's writing or anything. Where I think ego can lead us astray is when we just want more without questioning why. So if we just want more book sales and we don't even know why we want them, or we want to be on, say, the New York Times bestseller list, and we don't even know what that means or how that works. So I think it all kind of relates to a little bit of introspection around what we need versus what we want and why we want the things that we think we want, because maybe we don't.
It's interesting. I think so much of this comes from almost a myth in the publishing industry that I think is not even really true now, which is you have to hype, do the launch, hit the list, and you can retire and you've made a million. And I mean, I like the fact that you're looking at more of a sort of a longer term approach, which is what I talk about. So, I mean, many authors listening will feel like they are not making enough right now, and that's completely fine if people are feeling that. But one of the things I really like that you were talking about is scaling up revenue without expenses. And this is something that's really prevalent right now in the author community, because the rise of paid advertising in particular is kind of, the expenses can grow and can outstrip your revenue quite quickly with things like online ads. So what are some ways that authors could scale up revenue without their expenses growing too much?
Yeah, I think just questioning what it is that you need. Like, do you need a brand new Apple laptop when the one you've got works? Like, I replace my computers probably once every 7 years, if that. Same with my phone. Phones are so expensive now. I remember
battery life is so bad though after about 2.5 years.
Exactly. But it's like $2,000 for a tiny pocket computer. I think it's ridiculous. So I think looking at all of the expenses that we have and seeing like what we need, what we don't need. Like, I don't need an office to write. I can sit, like, this is my house. I'm sitting in my house right now in a spare bedroom that I share with my pet. And it's more his room than mine. So I don't need the expense of an office. I don't need business cards because I live in the woods on an island. I don't actually see people where I could give a business card to. I haven't had business cards in probably 15 years. The other thing to think about is, if you grow your revenue, how much is it going to cost to grow your revenue? Because I think a lot of people get obsessed with the gross number, whereas we should be paying attention to the net number. So I don't care how much money I bring in for gross revenue, I care what my profit is after my expenses are taken out of the equation. So I would rather spend less, but make the same amount, and then I have more profit versus spending more to make more. And it doesn't always work out. Like, I've never done any paid advertising because I don't think that it's necessarily worth it for the things that I do. And I mean, remember, I'm focused on a smaller audience that gets me, that doesn't need paid ads. Like, they find me through other means, and things like email marketing is perfect for me because I can write a newsletter. I like writing. So I write an article once a week. I've done that for 6 years. Actually, 6 years, 2 days. I started my newsletter 6 years ago on, I think, November 10th or so. So I've been writing this newsletter for over 6 years now, and it's called the Sunday Dispatches. So I release an article, obviously, every Sunday. And that to me has been the best way to both connect with my existing audience, which I think a lot of authors don't think about. They're always looking at getting new people to read their books, as opposed to making sure that the people who are already paying attention are happy and are satisfied and like the work and like the new work. And I think if we stop paying attention to the audience we already have, and they're the ones who are already paying attention to us, then I think things can easily go awry. So I like to think about all of the ways that I can continue to reach my existing audience. And they actually tell a lot of people, like, I feel like they're my unpaid sales force. So as long as I keep them happy and engaged and I listen to what they have to say and I write things that they want to read, they go out and share that. They go out and share the things that I make and the things that I write more than, and it reaches more people that way than I could myself, even through paid advertisements.
Well, it's interesting because I think I heard about you on Being Boss podcast. Would that be?
Yeah.
And then I sign up for your email list that way. So I'm interested because I would assume you're an introvert because you... Yeah.
Very much. Yeah.
Because you live on an island, never go anywhere. I mean, you're, yeah. And so it's interesting because a lot of people listening, a lot of authors are also introverts. I'm an introvert. I do travel more than you do. But what are some of the ways then that people have found you? Because email marketing only works when people actually get on your email list. So what are some of the ways that you're getting people on that email list in an introvert fashion?
Yeah. So, I mean, having a consistent cadence. So for me, I've never missed a Sunday other than when I'm taking a break. Like I don't send emails during the holidays, like from about American Black Friday to the New Year. People are too busy then. I feel like nobody misses me then because everybody's getting too many emails then anyways. But otherwise, I have such a cadence with that list that people expect it. And then I try to make sure that the writing that I write is both interesting and valuable because then I feel like people are going to share that and people do share that. And when the thing I like about email is that people reply all the time, which is nice because I feel like I have a direct connection with my audience and I can see what resonates with them and what doesn't. So if I see one article, I got like 500 replies and it was shared tons of times versus another article where I got 10 replies and it wasn't really shared, then I can see, okay, my audience is really interested in this topic, but not this topic. So maybe I can write more about that or more in that style or around that idea. And then it fosters sharing. And then in the beginning, when I hadn't reached enough with my writing, I was doing writing for like different publications and just trying to get word out, trying to do interviews like the Being Boss show. So just trying to get, I was just trying to figure out, okay, these are the type of people that I want to reach. These are the type of people that would be in my audience if they knew about me. So where are they hanging out now? And I'll go to them. I'll try to meet them where they are already spending time. And then when they hear about me on those places or they read my words on those places, then they're going to come to my website. And all my website focuses on, there's no pop-ups, there's no distractions, there's no anything. The biggest thing is the sign-up. Mm. Every single page has the newsletter sign-up. So I know that my newsletter drives the majority of my revenue and is responsible for the bulk of my book sales. So I focus a lot on that. And I focus my whole website. My website doesn't even really focus on selling anything because I know that people probably aren't going to buy right away. But if they're on my list and they read an article a week from me, if I keep showing up on their radar, if I keep showing up in their inbox, then they're going to buy something eventually. It's usually a couple months, but doesn't matter to me when they buy. If they're interested and they buy, then that's all that matters.
Mm. Well, I think email marketing is really good for, like you say, a company of one, because you can scale yourself through email marketing. What are some of the other systems that are important for scaling? And this is like, for example, the very first person I ever hired in my extended team was a bookkeeper, because it was like, this is something I'm not good at. Like, I do not want to reconcile my bank accounts and, you know, all of this type of stuff. So that to me was kind of scaling because I got a freelancer. So what are some of the systems that you have and what have you found successful in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have an accountant and bookkeeper. I'm good. I tell people, I'm good at making money. I'm not good at keeping track of that money. I don't know how to, and I mean, I think having an accountant and a bookkeeper should save you money, because it's funny because when you don't run a business, you think, well, I owe the government like a fixed amount based on my income. And it's never that way. A good accountant is going to find ways that you pay the government less, which is, I like that. I'm very cheap. Like, I like paying the government less of my hard-earned money.
And then you can give some to charity if you like, to those people listening who are like, ah!
Exactly. I do actually do a lot of animal related charity stuff. So I mean, again, yeah. So if I'm spending less on giving the government money, then I can put more into what I care about, which is animal welfare stuff. The other thing is I have a lawyer, and I think that that's really important as well, because if you're running a business, your business needs to, one, be set up properly, and two, you need to be the least liable as possible should anybody want to take issue with you. Even for things like reviewing contracts, I think that that's really important. Like that to me is a huge thing. And I mean, for me, I always look to figure out ways to be able to do more without having to spend a lot more and without having to manage. So for me, I know I'm really good at doing work. I'm not very good at managing people. I'm actually awful at managing people. Even things like making dinner, I do most of the cooking in the house. And if my wife is like, oh, how can I help with dinner? I'm like, I don't know. Like, I'm very bad at giving people tasks. So in my business, I only hire people that don't require any management. So I hire people who are really good at what they do. They may cost a little more, but I don't need to manage them. So for example, my copy editor, we communicate in emojis. So we have a share.
That's a great copy editing tip.
So weird. But so we have a shared Google Drive folder. So when I write an article, it goes to there. He gets a notification. He sends me a thumbs up that he's received it. And then a pencil when the article is finished being copy edited. And then I send him a thumbs up when I've gone through the revision so he can have one final pass. I don't need to ask him if he's doing his job. I don't need to tell him, hey, you need to do this work. He just does it. And I don't need to manage him. Same with my podcast editor. Same with my like more developmental editor. Same with my accountant, my lawyer. All of the people that I work with, the small team I have, one, they're all freelancers, so I don't have to worry about HR or I don't know how any of that works. Exactly. I don't want to be responsible for any person other than myself. So then I know that they work on other things and I'm happy that they do, because if I don't have work for them, I don't need to pay them. And then two, I pay them more than typical because they're really good at what they do and they don't require management. So I can have as much time as possible to do the work I like. And I don't have to spend time like managing them or having meetings. Like I don't like any of that stuff. So I would rather just pay them a premium for the A players. They do their job well without interference for me.
Yeah.
And so that to me works so well.
Yeah, it's so funny. I was just thinking, I have a really wonderful virtual assistant, Alexandra. Hi, Alexandra. and we've been working together like nearly 5 years and we've spoken twice or three times, maybe. Yeah. And it's so funny because I think this might be the company of one introvert author thing. I don't know, but it's quite common in our space to be like that. And it just works super well. So I really like that. So let's talk. So what you are good at, I really noticed, is saying no, because I think you also took a break on your email when you were writing the book. I seem to remember you did emailed and said, right, bye bye, I'll be back later. I don't know how long the break was, but can you talk about saying no? Because I feel like it's very hard to say no, and many of us struggle with this. How do you manage your time and like not offend people without feeling guilty?
Yeah, so the first thing is I went from being a child to being a curmudgeon-y old man, so that helped.
How am I going to do that?
I went straight from 9 to like 73, but I think a lot of people have said, well, it's okay for you to have boundaries because you're where you're at. And I correct them. And I'm like, I've always had boundaries. And I think that's why I'm where I'm at. So I think for me, boundaries are important because if you don't set them with other people, they're going to set them for you. And you may not like where that boundary ends up. So when I was doing work with clients, I would always say, I'm completely available between this hour and this hour of the day. If you call or email after those hours, I'll get back to you the following day. And so I wouldn't get calls at 3 a.m. or emails that needed a response at 11. And I go to bed really early. So I wouldn't get emails at 11 and expect a response because I set that very clear boundary. Even with writing, my publisher said in the contract, it said that I would do a 3-week book tour. I don't want to do a book tour. I don't like speaking. I also feel like I'm not a big enough deal. I couldn't go to any one city and like sit there and have a crowd of people. It would be me this is just a story in my mind. It would be like myself with a stack of books and like a cardboard cutout of myself. And I'd just be sitting there twiddling a pen. So I didn't feel like that was a good use of my time. So I challenged it. I was like, I don't want to sign this contract if I have to do a book tour. And my agent was like, well, are you sure you want to go to bat for this? Like they may not want to work with you. I'm like, if they don't want to work with me for something that silly, then we'll find another publisher. Like it doesn't matter. And in the end, the publisher didn't care. They're like, okay, that was just boilerplate anyways. We'll take it out.
Yeah, just before you go on, that is so true. And people just assume this stuff. But again, yeah. Like as an introvert, you're going to do much better doing a whole load of stuff like podcasts and writing than you ever, mm-hmm. you'd reach far more people than doing a physical bookstore. It's just signing. It's crazy that they still include that in a boilerplate.
There's a lot of crazy things about the publishing industry, but that's another conversation. But I think that the point there is that a lot of times we feel like what we want to say no to or where we want to set our boundaries is scary because we think it's going to be a big deal to the other side. It typically isn't. Mm. And then the other thing for setting boundaries that makes it less scary is if you make it our general rule as opposed to something personal. So what I mean by that is somebody will invite me to do a speaking gig at a conference. And when I reply, I'll say, I don't do speaking gigs. I've never done them. I'm not interested in doing them, which is a lot better than saying, I don't want to do your speaking gig. Mm. It's just a rule. It's a general rule I have. So it's not personal to you. It's just, this is just not what I do. So I always try to think of, when I say no to things or when I set boundaries about things, I think about how I can make it a rule because then it's not specific to that person. It's just a general rule. Like people don't have problems with rules. Like in society, we pretty much follow rules fairly well. So the more that we can set our boundaries around rules, the easier it becomes to enforce those rules because then it's just, this is a rule. Like you can't argue the rule.
Mm. No, I like that a lot. I've been, as we talk now, I've just done what is my last speaking gig on my calendar that I had booked a long time ago. And now I kind of want to set that rule, but I'm also quite scared of setting that rule. So it's a challenging thing to set boundaries, especially if you're trying to move your boundaries from where they were. Like, you know, mm-hmm. 10 years ago when I started out, I needed to speak to make some income. Yes. You know, so again, quite different. So I wanted to also ask about mindset issues because mindset is something that is so, I feel like goes up and down. And especially we're in an environment of quite sort of fear in the media right now. And people feel like companies might be struggling or, you know, and growth is super important because of that reason. So what are some of the mindset issues that company of ones face and how do we get over that?
Yeah, I think that a lot of nonfiction writers really try to be like, this is the thing that like, this is the blueprint. My book is the blueprint. My thesis is the blueprint that everybody should follow. I'm not really like that. I feel like Company of One, the book is more just a way for people to better think about the questions that they might have around building their business. And so the book really just brings up questions, right? So things like, why do you want more? Like, why do you really want more? Because a lot of times we'll tell ourselves like a BS answer. And then we have to kind of like get past those stories we tell ourselves. We also need to, we also need to think about like, how much is enough? And how will we know when we've reached enough? And then what will change in the way that we work or in the way that we do things once we've reached enough? We talked about this as well, but like, does this growth serve just my ego? And is that good? Is that a good or a bad thing? Mm. The other thing is how does growth serve or help our existing audience? Because maybe it doesn't. Maybe our audience likes the fact that we're fairly accessible. Like I'm a pretty accessible person. If somebody replies to my newsletter, I'm going to reply back if they ask a question. Whereas if my newsletter was 1 million people and I got thousands of replies instead of hundreds of replies, maybe I couldn't do that. So like, I don't even want a bigger audience at this point. Like I like that I can have that interaction with my audience because I feel like it helps me just as much as it may help my audience. The other thing is to think about what the maintenance costs of saying yes to things are, mm-hmm. because maybe saying yes to a certain opportunity could mean, oh, well, you need to hire like 3 more people. Do you want to manage 3 more people? And I mean, for me, the answer is always pretty much a resounding no. The other thing to think about are things like and we spoke about this as well, like how does this growth affect my profit, my net profit? And then how does it affect my happiness? Like, would I be happier? And I think a lot of times we need to work backwards into the life that we want, thinking about what it daily entails. Because if I had a bigger company, my day would be filled with managing that company. I like doing work. Like, I really like writing. I really like making things on the internet. So if I had a bigger company, I would have to manage the people doing the work that I want to do. I would be promoting myself out of the job I want, which doesn't mean like there's no logical sense. So I think those are some of the kind of specific things that we can think about to challenge the prevailing mindset that growth is always good and always beneficial, because I don't necessarily think that it is.
Mm. Well, just coming back then on ego, and there are a lot of mindset issues in the independent author community around social standing when there's traditionally published authors at a conference and independent authors at a conference. And some days I think the stigma of self-publishing has gone away. And other days I'm like, whoa, what's happening? You know, I go to an event and I'm like, okay, that's really interesting. Now, you've done both indie and traditional. So what do you think are some of the ego things around the different types of publishing, and how does that, you know, has that impacted your choices in any way?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is the grass is always greener. Like when I was independently publishing books, I felt like, oh, if I was traditionally published, I would have all of this help and it would make me seem like a more legitimate author. And now that I have a traditional publishing deal, I'm like, there's a lot of good things about independent publishing, like being able to pick my cover. And just, I feel like I'm doing the same amount of work to promote the book when I was on my own versus having a publisher. So I don't feel like there's much change. I think we all just want what we can't have or what we don't have. Mm. So doing traditional publishing for me was just an experiment. I just wanted to see what traditional publishing was like. I actually like independent publishing and self-publishing a lot. I don't even know if my next book will be traditionally published. So it's more just I think the grass is always greener. And I think, I don't know. I think if somebody was going to be that, like turn their nose at somebody who's independently published, I wouldn't want to talk to that person anyways, like at a conference. Like why would I want to talk to somebody that's just going to be that much of a dope about things? I think there's benefits on either side. And I think a lot of it is work you have to do on your own, whether you have a publisher or not. So yeah. I feel like I'm doing the same amount of work. I feel like the biggest benefit to traditional publishing was I got to work with the editor that I really, really wanted to work with. And he works at a major publishing house. So that was my option.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. And it is kind of tied into your overarching theme, which is sort of looking at the questions around what mm-hmm. you really want. And if you really want to work with that editor, then yes, that's where you go. And you can, the pros and cons on the other side, whatever. So I'm really interested, we're almost out of time, but one of the things you talk about is this resilience and ability to adapt in the face of change, which is one of the things I love about being independent. We can move so fast, like I can just jump on a thing, whereas, you know, bigger companies take a longer time to kind of move. And you do mention AI and the end of jobs. And I've just been listening to AI Superpowers, which is a new book that's just come out, and really thinking about how this is going to work. And so what makes or what can make a company of one resilient in a future where we're looking at such fast-paced change?
Yeah, I mean, I think I kind of approach this from, like, I've been working for myself for 2 decades now, and I want to keep working for myself for probably another 2 decades. And I think that a lot of it, and Dean Becker, who's the CEO of Adaptive Learning Systems, he's studied resilience since, I think, like 1997. And he found that resilience above education, training, experience, like that's what leads to success in any business. Mm. And so there's 3 traits that he found that all resilient people have. The first is accepting reality, because we can't control everything. And I think this is especially important to authors, because we think, oh, well, I want to be on like the bestseller list or hit number one on Amazon. And I think that's a good thing to shoot for, but there's no guarantee to get there. Like it doesn't matter who you are. A lot of the New York Times specifically, that's editorialized that list. Mm. So they pick who they want on the list.
Yeah.
Even the lists that are based entirely on numbers, which is a bit more meritocratic, but still, like, you don't know what book is coming out that week. Like if J.K. Rowling has a book out that week, you're not going to sell more books than So I think a lot of times we just have to accept reality. And like, what would that even do for us? And sometimes it's nothing. Like, how can we instead get the book out in places we can control, like to our own audience, who are probably waiting to read the book and are probably really happy that the book is coming out. So accepting reality is first trait. Second trait is having a sense of purpose. And I think that's super important for authors, because if you're writing just to make a lot of money or to rank on lists, that's fine, but you can't control that. So it's probably not going to last very long. If you're writing because you feel like you have a point of view that needs to be shared, or you have a story that other people need to hear, then ranking on those lists or selling this number versus this number doesn't really matter. Like, if you have a sense of purpose, it's going to keep you going long term. Mm. Having a sense of purpose that's related to those kind of like vapid or ephemeral things is really hard to keep that going long term. Third thing is the ability to adapt. And I think this is really where companies of one or smaller businesses have a leg up on bigger businesses, because things are always changing. Even the way that self-publishing works, almost every month it changes. Like, when I first started publishing, there was no KDP program. Yeah. So there wasn't Create Space and Kindle Direct. So it was a lot harder to sell independent books. Mm. Now independent books show up in the exact same places and in the exact same way that traditionally published books show up. They're all in this, they're not sorted, right, on Amazon. It's just, this is the book. So I think being able to adapt and being able to change, just like you said, when you're one person or when you're a smaller team, it's easy to adapt and pivot. If you're a big company, it takes a lot to move. Like, imagine how hard it would be for a company like Google to change directions entirely on what they do. They have tens of thousands of employees. Mm. It wouldn't even happen. They're so big. Whereas you or I can just be like, okay, maybe I want to write about something different. Like, I moved from writing vegan cookbooks to writing a book about creativity, to writing a book about online business, to where I'm at now. It's like, I can pivot whenever I want based mm-hmm. on what my audience needs and based on what I want to focus on. So I think those three things, accepting reality, having a sense of purpose, and having the ability to adapt or pivot quickly, can really help us when we're just a smaller organizational unit to be able to make things work long term. Like, I don't want to be a writer of one book. I want to be a writer of lots of books. So I want to keep going. And I think those are the things that will help me be able to keep going in the long term.
Yeah, I agree with you, because, you know, if it's not AI, it's whatever else it is, or it's difficulties with Amazon. There's always a new technical challenge, but it's yes. the overarching concepts that I think are really important. And so I highly recommend Company of One. I really enjoyed it. And as I said, as soon as I heard the title, I wanted to buy it. I think it's brilliant. So I hope everyone listening goes and gets that. So where can people find you and everything you do online?
Yeah, so ofone.co is the book's website, and there's a bunch of pre-order bonuses there. PJRVS.com is my website, so that's where the newsletter that we were talking about, the Sunday Dispatches, lives. So if you Google Paul Jarvis, I come up on the first couple pages, so I'm pretty easy to find, even though my URL is not easy to remember. So
it's one of those really old ones, isn't it, where you set something up and then thought about it later.
Exactly. I registered that so long ago, and it was more just to prove a point, like the URL doesn't matter. So I picked a really hard to remember one.
And then it just kind of stuck.
Exactly. And then it just kind of stuck, and now I'm stuck with it.
There's another little tip right at the end of our show. Pick something you can say out loud on a podcast.
Exactly. Like, ofone.co is way easier than PJRVS.
Either way, thank you so much for your time, Paul. That was great.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So I hope you enjoyed this interview with Paul Jarvis today, and definitely go and check out his book, Company of One. And I hope it gives you some ideas for scaling your revenue without scaling the size of your business, if that's what you fancy. So next week, I'm talking about email lists and newsletter tips with Tammy Labreck. And she has a fantastic book out, Newsletter Ninja, something like that. But she's amazing. Like, and she does a great interview as well. So it's a good one. coming up. And it's a practical show. So we talk about really specific tips, whether you're just starting out or if you're someone who wants to do better with your email list. And let's face it, that's all of us. I wrote down several things from Tammy, which, to be fair, I should have done ages ago. And I still, you know, I'll probably still put them on the do later list. But yeah, really good interview coming up next week. So happy writing and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.